Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Essenflow.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
And we are back again with our daily podcast, going through all these wonderful adventures that Sherlock Holmes and Watson keep having. This one, the adventure of the second stain, the last story in the collection of The Return of Sherlock Holmes.
The final story, Steve. It's the final story.
And it feels like a final story, doesn't it?
Well, it does. It does. It certainly has the buildup of, like, even the beginning part where he's like, well, I've been talking about not releasing this one. But here we are. We're going to release it.
For me, it reads like the final tale of a long narrative arc. It's kind of like Avengers Endgame here.
Well, maybe if Robert Downey Jr. was in it, maybe we could figure that out.
He'll never play Sherlock Holmes.
Never.
Wait, already.
Well, and it's true that in the opening, Watson says that he had intended The Adventures of Abbey Grange to be the last story of Sherlock ever. And then he just wanted to do this one more. And it's funny, he says the reason he's going to stop writing stories is because Sherlock asked him to. But, and I quote, so long as he was in actual professional practice, the records of his successes were of some practical value to him. But since he has definitely retired from London and betaken himself to study and bee farming on the Sussex Downs, notoriety has become hateful to him. Now, let me ask, especially Chip, first-time reader, did you guys expect Holmes to retire to a life of beekeeping?
No.
Isn't it a funny detail?
Of all the things. You could have just said, well, he retired to plant flowers. You know, it could have been... It just seems to be thrown out there as something. Okay, that's what he's
just
going
a hobby. Something
very British.
Retirement.
Very British.
Very British for sure.
And he's such a scientist, right? And I'm super excited to go back and read Study in Scarlet with you guys, the first novel, where we really, you know, see the sort of first descriptions of Holmes. But he's a scientist and he's super interested in chemistry. And so to me, it's rather funny that he's going into this very sort of retiring lifestyle of beekeeping, of, you know, like making organic honey. You know, it's just not what I would expect from Holmes. There's something, it's an outlandish little detail, I think.
I don't know if you've ever watched a program or read an article about, you know, professional beekeepers who basically have the hives on the back of a truck and they'll arrive at some California location, you know, throw open the sides and the bees go and they pollinate everything. You know, beekeeping's a very interesting profession, you know, so... And it does take, it is a science.
Right, absolutely.
And yeah. you don't want your bees to get sick. There's all mm-hmm. sorts of things that can happen. It follows along with what we know of his interests.
But at the same time, given that he struggles with anything that's routine, it feels like this retirement might be problematic for Holmes.
But it's certainly an individual thing.
Well, you can always go out there and get the poppy seeds, the poppy flowers out there. So maybe there's something that
could... Poppy can make us sleepy.
That could possibly work to his advantage.
Oh, boy.
So we now get here, this is a very deep, very European politics kind of a story here. The Prime Minister of Britain enters the rooms along with the Right Honorable Trelawney Hope, the name that is the most British name you could possibly put together. He is Secretary of European Affairs.
Yes, and did it feel to you guys a little bit like the naval treaty?
The whole time I was going, all right, did I read this one before? Have I read this story before? Because I was immediately going, oh my goodness, I'm on the wrong story.
It didn't feel that much like the naval treaty, but it sort of had that feeling of, you know, this document was taken, nobody knows where it is, it's very, there's some interesting women in the neighborhood, who really knows what's going on.
And I think that that is the wrap-up of this narrative arc. I think that we have the shorthand for so many of these things because we've read these stories.
And think about the very first lost document we had was from the scandal in Bohemia, the cabinet-sized picture of Irene Adler. And so we do have this notion of the lost document that will have international consequences, that has come up several times. And, you know, that actually is, it comes from Poe, the purloined letter written decades earlier in 1845, where we have a very important document that would put the Queen of England in a difficult position if it were ever found. And it's funny because, have you guys read the purloined letter?
No.
I have not.
It's a wonderful, wonderful story, and I don't mean to give it away, but...
Professor, I don't want more homework.
But it's, I'll just say it's hiding in plain sight. And so I feel like Holmes's move at the end of this story to put the letter back where it was, kind of a little bit of an homage to Poe, I would say.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We have so many of the elements of Doyle's writing all wrapped up here. I really enjoyed the, again, that shorthand, that knowledge that I brought because we've read these other stories, that he doesn't have to explain certain things. We know because we are informed readers.
Well, we know where the tobacco's kept. It's in a sheet.
And the brandy.
Always now, there in case somebody faints.
And I really like that, you know, the Prime Minister and the European Secretary, they're very hesitant to take Holmes and his companion into, you know, top level diplomatic secrets of the nation, which makes perfect sense. And Holmes has a ton of power here, right? He says, oh, well, if, you know, without any further information, I'm not going to be able to help you, so have a great day. And then they're like, fine, we'll tell you things. So they start to tell him a little bit about the story, and Holmes writes a name upon a slip of paper and hands it to the premier. And the premier nods, yep, that's who we're talking about. I kind of love that, like, Holmes doesn't know the most famous rugby player in England, but he does appear to know politics.
You only know what you know, Pam. There's a list of things that I am not knowledgeable about, and that's okay.
Of course. But isn't it funny? Like, I guess I just think of Holmes. I didn't think of him as someone who would follow politics so, so closely. But of course, it does make sense as he's working in criminal world that he has a good sense of political players across Europe.
Are we suggesting that politics and criminals could be working together?
Well, we spies.
Spies?
International spies that we have that come up in about a minute in the story. Yeah, absolutely. Holmes decides it must be one of three international spies and secret agents. And he knows the names of these spies and secret agents, which is, that doesn't make much sense, but that's okay. He says, there are only those three capable of playing so bold a game. There's Oberstein, La Rotrie, I said that in French, Pam, and Eduardo Lucas, which is very much not in French. It turns out Watson is reading the paper and Eduardo Lucas was murdered in his home last night. Dun, dun, dun.
And I love Watson's feelings about that. When he reads out of the paper, Watson says, my friend has so often astonished me in the course of our adventures that it was with a sense of exultation that I realized how completely I had astonished him. It's like, I mean, it's not like you know, did this amazing deduction you read out of the newspaper, but it was still pretty cool.
And the little detail that he is an amateur tenor, that he is known for his singing on an amateur level. This is an interesting super spy. I think we could certainly write some stories of Eduardo Lucas before his demise here.
Well, you know, it seems like an important piece. And you can see later on where this plays, the homage to this comes out when Team America, when they go get an actor, Steve, Gary, the actor. Right. To his international spirit. They only can be saved by an actor.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if you're aware of Team America, but maybe.
I'm not.
The greatest puppet movie ever.
Oh, sacrilege!
And interestingly,
this show is over.
My university, the University of Connecticut, has one of the premier puppetry programs in the. I'm sure I have friends who know all about it.
Steve loves puppetry.
I love puppetry. Puppetry is absolutely awesome. My favorite art. I enjoy the art of puppetry so much. Okay.
How about being a tenor?
Yes, let's get back to this. If you're an international spy, you need a cover story. And being an amateur tenor, a well-known amateur tenor, lends itself to traveling all over the place, so you have a reason for going to different places to do your spy work.
I am trying to think. There was a movie that came up that Justin Bieber was a spy, and his superstardom was a cover of that.
I can't remember.
I can't remember what it was.
I don't think that's a movie, Chip. I think that's true.
Well, the tattoos give him away.
He has a valet named Mittens? Seriously?
I think it's just Mitten, singular.
Oh, just one Mitten. It might even be Michael Jackson.
Mitten. M-O-N.
Okay.
I don't
okay,
know.
Fine.
As long as you say it in French, like I'm okay.
Then Lady Hilda Trelawney Hope, the wife of the secretary who has lost the letter, enters. The most lovely woman in London, Watson reports.
Ever.
Once again. No
hyperbole there.
Not the first time we've heard this about a woman who enters their quarters, but it's so interesting because lately the beautiful women have not been looking their best. Remember in the last story, the Abbey Grange, the beautiful woman is like pale and drawn. And here too, quote, the cheek was lovely, but it was paled with emotion. The eyes were bright, but it was the brightness of fever. The sensitive mouth was tight and drawn in an effort after self-command. Terror, not beauty, was what sprang first to the eye as our fair visitor stood framed for an instant in the open door. Now, I love that he says that after writing like a whole paragraph about her beauty. And then he says, but the first thing I noticed was that she was super afraid.
Yeah, really good description from Doyle again here. She's tall, graceful, and intensely womanly.
And we should not at all be suspicious of her because, you know, what she asks for. It's crazy.
Right. She asks Holmes to tell her what was in this top secret government letter. That's.
I would ask my husband, but you know, I'm going to ask you.
He wouldn't tell me because it's top secret.
Oh my God. What is that? You're not suspicious at all.
She asks the follow-up question, is my husband's political career likely to suffer through this incident? That's an odd question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That is very strange that she would be concerned about his career.
The perception that he's trustworthy or not.
Well, and it's interesting because in this collection of The Return of Sherlock Holmes, we've had mentioned several times that Sherlock is really very charming with women when he wants to be, right? He got engaged to Melverton's maid. He's had lots of luck at the telegram office, etc. Now, he also, in this story, he tells Watson straight up, he feels like he totally doesn't understand women. And there's two quotes that I really liked. Now, Watson, the fair sex is your department, said Holmes with a smile, when the dwindling frou-frou of skirts had ended in the slam of the front door, i.e. when Lady Hope leaves. What was the fair lady's game? What did she really want? And Watson doesn't know either. And then afterwards, Holmes goes on, says, you remember the woman at Margate whom I suspected for the same reason? No powder on her nose. That proved to be the correct solution. How can you build on such a quicksand? Their most trivial action may mean volumes, or their most extraordinary conduct may depend upon a hairpin or a curling tong. He's just basically saying, I don't understand women.
Yes, in so many words, he's saying, what's going on here? Watson, you had a wife. Explain this to me.
And you've known women on three continents.
And isn't that the truth? I mean, come on, let's go with it.
I just love the frou-frou of skirts. That made me laugh so
Who
hard.
Who can understand women? I don't.
I don't get these frou-frou. Why are there frou-frou toothpicks? I don't understand. Why do they exist?
I'm just a guy.
All that day and the next, Holmes was in a mood, which his friends would call taciturn and others morose. He ran out and ran in, smoked incessantly, played snatches on his violin, sank into reveries, devoured sandwiches at irregular hours, and hardly answered the casual questions which I put to him. It was evident to me that things were not going well with him or his quest. This is a different kind of Holmes than we've seen in the past.
Well, he's dwelling, but he's eating, Steve.
Yes. Sandwiches at Irregular Hours is the title of my next album.
I like that.
I had a sandwich at an irregular hour yesterday, as a matter of fact. I just needed a sandwich. I couldn't explain it.
But yeah, this focus on the case, right? How he tries to, like, he tries to find something like playing the violin or just sitting almost in a meditative state to figure out the case. And this is something we've seen many, many times, is running around, and he seems really morose, but really it's just all internal work that he's doing.
He's not sharing much with Watson here. And Watson's
Welcome
not,
to Sherlock.
Mm-hmm. Watson's not able to share
Watson
much
sits
with
down. Watson sits down. You're crowding me out. You're not letting me in. He goes, there, Mr. Watson. I only talk to people who are my equals. You're just but a friend.
So we read in the papers more than we get any other information through this case. And Holmes read that Eduardo Lucas, his valet, Mittens, was arrested and later released.
That's like Liberace. He went total Liberace on us.
he's not called Mittens.
Mittens, Steve.
Oh, okay, sorry. That's French.
The French. The French here.
Lucas, as to his relations with women, they appeared to have been promiscuous but superficial. He had many acquaintances among them, but few friends, and no one whom he loved. His habits were regular, his conduct inoffensive. His death was an absolute mystery and likely to remain so. This was a clue that I didn't know was a clue when I put it into the notes.
This sounds so much like 007, you know, James Bond.
Yep.
He's a spy.
This is that super spy, that international man of mystery, for sure.
Does he have a theme song? That's all I need to know.
Yes, it's on the new album, Sandwiches at Irregular Hours.
And his conduct is inoffensive, unless you're offended by international spying.
Or dalliances with the opposite sex across waterways.
Money as long penny. As they're superficial.
Money penny.
Look at me now, Money Penny. Lestrade is mentioned fleetingly here. We do get a mention of him. He is giving Holmes information about the case from Scotland Yard, but Holmes is not sharing that with Watson or with the reader.
All right, so Lestrade shows back up, thank goodness, because now we get, you know, we go back to the first cases where Lestrade shows up. So he gets his wink and nod at the last story. Mm-hmm. But of course, Watson, who has, his self-esteem just continues to get ripped from him, is not privileged with any thoughts from Holmes. Good Lord. Pam, how does this work in a partnership?
It's interesting, though, because Watson doesn't really expect Holmes to tell him things. Like, Watson, I think, he just respects Holmes's strategy. He respects his process of, like, sitting in a very interior manner with all of the information. And I think that early on, Watson, it bothered him when Holmes wouldn't share, but I don't even think it bothers him anymore. It's just his process.
That is another throwback to this, the whole Holmes canon, where he talks about going to a small place to understand something on his level. This is definitely a wrap-up story. A telegram from Paris reports the police have discovered that Madame, you're going to say this one in French.
Madame Henri Fournet.
That's what I said. Only returned from a journey to London on Tuesday night, and there is evidence to connect her with the crime at Westminster. A comparison of photographs has proved conclusively that
Monsieur Henri Fournet.
That's what I said. And Eduardo Lucas were really one in the same person. Dun, dun, dun. And that the deceased had for some reason lived a double life in London and Paris. His companion, his wife in Paris, was of Creole origin and is of an extremely excitable nature and has suffered in the past from attacks of jealousy, which have amounted to frenzy. Creole women are extremely excitable. Finally, we get to another group of people that we can stereotype in Doyle's writing.
But yeah, you got to get the Caribbean in there, Steve, you know? But
we haven't gotten the Caribbean yet.
Well, they got the Creole. So yeah, there okay. you go.
This is our first frenzy. This is one of three times in the story where Doyle uses the word frenzy to describe the action of this story. This is so much a wrap-up, action-packed episode here. Finally, all of our study has paid off. We finally understand all of these shorthand pieces that Doyle has given us throughout all of these short stories that we've been reading. Holmes sends Lestrade out of the room to accuse the constable who was on watch at the murder scene. And Holmes immediately turns to Watson and shouts, "Now, Watson, now," cries Holmes with frenzied eagerness. There's more frenzy. They quickly find the loose board in the floor under the carpet to find the hidden spot where the letter could easily be hidden. Doyle doesn't explain any of this to us.
Wasn't this part of another story too?
Because it's already been done. This was the naval treaty. Mm-hmm. Under the carpet was a loose board. There was the paper. The reader already knows about hidden spots under floors, under carpets. So Doyle doesn't explain any of that to us. It just happens in such a wonderful way.
This is where we get the title, right? So the title, The Second Stain, doesn't come in until really late in the story, like three quarters of the way through, where you have the blood stain on the carpet. And it's not on the floor underneath it because the carpet has been moved.
Dun, dun, dun. And we find out who moved the carpet and who knew about the hidden spot and where the letter had to be. It was a young woman who charmed her way into the murder scene past this constable. She fainted. And of course, the constable hurried and fetched some brandy. There it is. We knew it was coming somewhere in the story.
In fact, we all should have brandy on hand, just in case. You never know when someone will faint.
Somebody faints.
It's a known cure.
The constable says that the young woman came to the door answering an advertisement about typewriting. Oh, good. We get a typist. We haven't had a typist in a while.
Solitary cyclist was our last typist.
Oh, my goodness. We're going to hit them all, aren't we?
This story has everything. It's just like Avengers Endgame, I'm telling you. As Holmes leaves, he shows the constable something that he has in his possession. Was the constable a double ruse here? Was he in on it with Holmes?
Ooh, I didn't think so, but that's an interesting thought. I don't know.
Holmes shows him something, shares something with the constable. The constable smiles in a very silent communication between he and Holmes.
I like that. I missed it. There you go.
Interesting.
Working with the police. There we go. Police are working with them.
But not just working with the police, because he's working with Lestrade in the room, but is he working with this constable on the outside of the room in a different way than he's working with Lestrade?
Steve, he's got spies everywhere. He's got kids running around, Steve.
I think that that's what we're looking at here, is Sherlock Holmes has these connections to make these crimes, to make these investigations happen. He has connections all across London. Holmes and Watson go to the Trelawney Hope home. They accuse Lady Hilda Trelawney Hope of being the wayward typist who entered the Eduardo Lucas murder scene. And she replies, "Oh, spare me, Mr. Holmes, spare me," she pleaded in a frenzy of supplication. There's your third frenzy of the story.
Well, that was after, well, she denies him. She denies him once, she denies him twice. She denies him a third time.
That's a different story. I think you're thinking of a different story.
Oh, my God.
Does that take place on Easter?
It could be. Could.
The lady does indeed have the letter. She did take it from the locked box in her husband's bedroom. She has a duplicate key to that locked box that is only for top secret documents from the government.
Well, just in case, Steve, what happens? What happens if he can't get in? She's there to help.
Well,
and you guys, I was reminded of a very early story, the Beryl Coronet, where the banker was like, "Ooh, this is way too valuable to leave in the bank. I'll take it home. It'll be way safer there." Well,
there you go.
Kind of was reminded right at the beginning when the secretary said, like, "I leave a lot of documents in my office," which presumably is quite a secure space, but this one was so important, I decided to take it home. And it's like, little do you know, buddy, your home, not as secure as you imagine.
Yeah, that occurred to me too at the beginning where that is mentioned. Like, why wouldn't you think that this safe is less secure than the movable box that you have in your bedroom?
Right.
Steve, Steve and Pam, the reason is because the story wouldn't be here unless the person had that type of logic.
Agreed. That is true, but still, that is some storytelling leaps that we have to make with Doyle here, isn't it?
Well, I agree.
She had a dark secret from her past. Oh, that sounds familiar. That's wrapping up some of the other storylines that we've read already. She had an indiscreet letter written before her marriage. She says, "A foolish letter, a letter of an impulsive, loving girl. I meant no harm, and yet he would have thought it criminal."
Oh, my God. What we could learn, I was going to say, my immediate thought is the Clintons certainly have a relationship where this wouldn't be a problem.
Confidence. It's important to have communication between husband and wife. She says, "Put yourself in my position, Mr. Holmes. What was I to do?" And Holmes replies straight out, "Take your husband into your confidence. Tell him what's happening in your life." She says, "I could not, Mr. Holmes. I could not."
That was the wife, and it was at the yellow face.
Yeah, the yellow face.
Mm-hmm. Where the husband was like, "Well, we have a bigger family now."
Yep.
Yeah. She's like, "Oh yes, I will not keep you in my confidence."
Yep. The story would have been a lot shorter that way. That's for sure.
But this, I think, guys, it also just speaks to Victorian mores and that idea that you had some sort of flirtation before you met your husband. Not acceptable. And I feel like this is one of those things that 120 years later, it's sort of hard to picture, but this is a, you know, common trope of literature of this period.
Okay. Before you meet somebody and you have a conversation with somebody else and that conversation is no longer okay because you met somebody afterwards, come on, Victorians, get with the time.
You should go back in time, Steve, and tell them that.
Okay, I'll do that next weekend. The secretary returns and is completely overjoyed to find the letter back in the secure, and I put it in quotes in the notes, secure, but not quite so secure, box. "But this is inconceivable, impossible," he says. "Mr. Holmes, you are a wizard, a sorcerer. How did you know it was there?"
As we learn with all magicians, it's always diversion.
That's right.
Exactly. There is no magic. There is another key. And they went and they decided it was, "Oh, you know what we could do? Let's just go put it back in the box." And then We'll just see if it works its way out.
We'll just tell him that he's dumb and he didn't see it. That's all.
Now, the prime minister is not so easily fooled, which brings us to the ending. And again, I love this idea that this is such a strong ending to this whole arc. The premier looked at Holmes with twinkling eyes. "Come, sir," said he. "There is more in this than meets the eye. How came the letter back in the box?" Holmes turned away, smiling from the keen scrutiny of those wonderful eyes. "We also have our diplomatic secrets," said he, and picking up his hat, he turned to the door. The end. And so that's a wonderful ending, I think, of just saying, "You have your secrets, I have mine." Holmes out.
All right, so I initially was reading this, I was going, "Oh, this is just awful, this is awful." But discussing it with you guys, this is a very playful story for the reader, because you're right, you just keep going back. For a person who has been there since the beginning, they get to go back and draw all the connections to all the other stories that they've read.
Yeah, I loved every part of that. Every one of those nods to the reader that Doyle is literally going, "Hey, remember my other stories? Remember how much fun you had with those? Here's Avengers Endgame." I like this very much.
Nice. So I'm actually super interested in tomorrow's wrap-up episode, because I can genuinely tell you guys, I have no idea which stories you guys are going to pick for your favorites of this collection.
I have my two already picked out for sure.
I have no idea. They will happen.
So I guess we'll have to ask everybody else. We'll have to ask all of the listeners, what was your favorite of the collection of The Return of Sherlock Holmes? We'd love to hear from you. I'll post it all over social media, and we can get all of your answers, and we can have a good discussion over this particular collection of puzzles. Because I think that we've talked about how some of these are much more mature, and some of them maybe fall flat a little bit, huh? Maybe we talked about a couple of stories that we really didn't like.
A little hit and miss here.
Yeah, we'll find out. We'll find out what our listeners think. Give us a call or a text. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your voice. Record a voicemail on our phone line or follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all of that feedback from around the world. We'll be back tomorrow to wrap up The Return of Sherlock Holmes before we get started on our next Sherlock Holmes adventure. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hussenflug.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
We'll see you in the future. Release the bicycles!